This episode discusses sensitive subject matter that may be triggering for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. The Local Thread.
Welcome to Toledo Works. I'm your host, Stephen Zenner, an investigative reporter with the Toledo Free Press. I, along with Jaden Jefferson, will be bringing you a glimpse into the lives of those who work and live in Toledo. Today's topic is women's health. We'll be talking to Shelley Varelli, a licensed and certified midwife, and also Amelia Stower with the Toledo Women's Center. My first guest is Shelley Varelli. She's a licensed and certified professional midwife and doula. Hi, Shelley. How are you doing today?
I am great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
What people may be interested in is, what is a midwife or what is a doula? Is there a difference between the two?
Absolutely. And first off, I want to have an understanding of your basic concept. Are you familiar?
I am not super familiar. I have interviewed doulas and midwives before, but I am not super clear on the distinction between the two.
Well, that makes our conversation personal, as well as to the broader public. There are many people who do not understand what the differences is between midwives in general. There are several different types of midwives and doulas. I am actually no longer practicing as a doula, as I have transitioned into full clinical practice as a midwife. And doulas provide support, advocacy, education in a non-clinical perspective. And so they're hired by folks to help them get through the birth process or provide some sort of postpartum care that is, you know, more comfort measures and, again, education, advocacy. And as a midwife, we're trained in caring for folks all through the spectrum of their childbearing years. My particular focus is on birth. So I care for folks as soon as they enter into their pregnancy, throughout their labor, and through 6 weeks postpartum.
I was looking into some of your background, and it sounds like, did you start out as a midwife or as a doula, or how did you get into that?
Yeah, I started in my journey as a birth worker, as an assistant to a midwife. Then I became a doula as kind of part of bringing that full spectrum of care into the practice. So I assisted a midwife for about 8 years until I decided that I wanted to officially apprentice and start on that journey of becoming a midwife. I ended up stepping away from the work for a little while. And it was in 2018 that some other midwife friends of mine sat me down and said, "What are you doing? Like, it's time to, like, go for it." So I enrolled in midwifery school in 2018. My clinical preceptorship took me about 4.5 years, and I've been a practicing midwife for about 3 years now.
How old were you when you kind of started that assistant role?
It was after the birth of my first child. Maybe a little bit sooner than that. So I was in massage therapy school, which is still an active practice of mine, doing body work, and I focus specifically on women and pregnant women. In 2001, I graduated from massage therapy school with a focus on pregnancy massage, and I approached the midwife who had a birth center in our area, and I was like, "Hey, do you have a massage therapist you work with?" She did not. I basically moved in the next day and became her assistant.
Nice.
And that's kind of how my journey started rolling.
So it had a personal connection to you as well.
Yes.
So do you think you would have started as a doula or a midwife if you had not had a child yourself?
Yes. If you go all the way back to high school, how many of us have, you know, filled out that line that says, "What is your future goal or endeavor in life?" And I actually put that I wanted to be an OBGYN at that time. I did not know what midwives were.
Okay, so similar. So
yeah.
In a similar field.
Similar field. It was my home ec teacher who said to me, "You know, this assignment we just did shows me that you have what it takes. Like, you should be a midwife." And I was like, "Well, I don't know what that is."
What was that assignment?
It was the anatomical progression of a fetus through its evolution to from conception to birth.
Were you kind of like creating a project to display for people? Okay, so you just did a really good job kind of explaining the process of the development of the fetus.
I'm a little bit of an overachiever.
Well, that's what you want. That's what you would want, right? That's what you would want from somebody caring for yourself in the process of pregnancy and beyond.
Yeah. And my grandfather was a wonderful role model for me, and he was a nurse. And I always thought that I would go into nursing or some sort of healthcare. And when that idea was pitched to me, I thought, well, again, I don't know what a midwife is. It wasn't in my world, as many people still to this day, as we've already acknowledged, don't really know what a midwife is. I was like, well, I'll just be an OBGYN. I didn't know how I was going to get there. I didn't have great grades. I was not a stellar student, even though I overachiever, you know, perfectionist. So I joined the military and thought that they would help me because that's what they promise folks, right? That's what they promise, especially folks who don't have a means for education.
What branch of the military did you join?
Army.
Okay, so you joined the Army.
I did.
In hopes of being an OBGYN. Yeah.
Right. It wasn't about duty to God and country at all. It was about how can I get what I want? And, nice. You know, they're really great at promising you that as an end goal.
What was kind of the thing that led you into the assistant midwife kind of role? How did that get detoured?
Well, so on a slightly more personal note, in 2001, I had the first pregnancy that I intended, and it was a loss, and I was devastated. And I entered into the world of holistic healing.
Okay.
And I started doing Reiki as an energy source for myself and others. It's energy healing.
Okay.
And then quickly began working as a massage therapist. I went to school in Ann Arbor for massage therapy. That is where my passion for those things were reignited. And I was reminded by working with the midwives who cared for me and by doing all these, you know, traditional holistic types of studies. Remember that thing that you said you wanted to do when you were 17 years old?
So even with a pregnancy that may not have turned out the way that you had intended, midwives do have a role even in that kind of
absolutely.
A scenario. So how did you receive care at that time yourself?
Well, I found some certified professional midwives who then moved me into the certified nurse midwife world. So then there is a difference between what clinically those two different types of midwives can do. And so I was needing the assistance of nurse midwives at that time with a higher level of medical care who worked with OBs. And I ended up having a loss at 21 weeks of pregnancy, and that required some medical management. So they were wonderful. It was really a life-altering experience.
What did that care look like, especially as a man? I'm not super clear on what that would look like or how they would be able to help you. It sounds like they helped you a lot.
They did. I was a sonographer at the time. I've worked in medicine my whole life, mostly. And so I'd had an ultrasound in the office that revealed that there was some problems with the baby's anatomical structures. And we just moved forward through the progression of having a coronavillic sampling where they stick a needle in your belly and look for genetic anomalies. And sure enough, there was a tragic anomaly that was incompatible with life. And I was quickly moved forward to the extension invitation of a medical induction of pregnancy. And we did have to clear some channels through the hospital system because that's not something that they, I was working in a hospital that was a, we'll say Catholic, religious. And so that goes against your typical values. But because there was a genetic anomaly, they granted the request for a medical induction. And the midwives were with me the entire time. I received comfort measures in the forms of medication and things of that nature and delivered the baby in the hospital and got lots of therapy after that.
Right. And how did they induce the pregnancy? Did they give you some medication? Or?
Yes. Okay. There's oral medication. There were little tiny seaweed sticks that were placed in the cervix to cause cervical dilation. Basically, they expand with the mucus of the body and start cervical dilation. Then medication through various forms to the progression of an actual expulsion.
Okay. And then the...
Yes, it was a vaginal birth.
How many midwives were kind of with you at that time? Sounds like there were a collection.
There were two that played a pretty prominent role. And of course, my family was there with me as well.
And it sounds like they were not only professionals explaining what was going to happen, mm-hmm. but also a form of emotional help to you. Is that kind of
very
correct?
True? Yes. Okay. And midwives have a way of doing that, right? We're very personal. Mm-hmm. The care and comfort that we provide to clients is more than just clinical care, more mm-hmm. than just what is your blood pressure, what is your pulse. We actually sit with our clients throughout our care, usually about an hour for each appointment, talking about the whole body experience, what, you know, your stress levels are, how are you eating, how are you moving your body, you know, your nutrition, all those things come into factor and really bring a personal relationship in.
Right. And it sounds like that was a devastating moment for you.
Absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was that before you had any kids at all?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now you have... Now you have three kids.
I do.
And
I've had other losses along the way as well. So, I mean, then that is the thing with pregnancy that most folks don't realize. Probably one in four pregnancies end in a miscarriage, and not everyone is even aware that they were pregnant before they start spotting or bleeding. They think it's just their next menstrual cycle. And then there are folks that, you know, get that positive pregnancy stick and have a loss within weeks or days later after that. And we coach them through that as well.
By your first successful pregnancy, mm-hmm. were you already in this field or how did your first pregnancy, successful pregnancy?
I was still working as a sonographer and mm-hmm. also working as a massage therapist and a doula. So those... All the things kind of having to be balanced in my life before finally coming to the...
Kind of dancing around it a little bit, it sounds like.
Yeah, the natural evolution was, hey, you need to start narrowing your focus.
Okay. When did you kind of decide that? Was that after you had already had some kids? I know you have three kids.
Yeah. You know, well, life is many roads, right?
So, okay, yeah.
It was 2001 was when I officially started working in birth work as an assistant and working as a doula throughout the next couple of years. In 2008, I had to back away from the field for a little bit.
Okay.
I had to return to working full-time as a sonographer. And I still managed to juggle both, but my full-time job was the priority for another decade. And then in 2018, like I said, it was like just this was 2 years after the birth of my last child, and I had posted on social media that I was interested in getting back into birth work, and I was looking for someone local that was looking for a student.
Okay.
And no one was available at the time. And so I thought, okay, well, I know how to make things happen. I'm just going to go to nurse midwifery school.
Okay.
And I enrolled and I was on my way to the first session at the college. And I got a phone call from a midwife in Ann Arbor. And she's like, hey, my student just quit. Are you still interested? I just saw your post. And I was like, well, that's interesting. That post was a year ago. And like, I'm on my way to like nursing school orientation. So let me think about this for a minute. And I was shaking, my heart was racing, and I knew that was my call back. And so I called her. I went into the orientation. I sat there for 15 minutes and I got up and left.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, I know exactly what path I'm supposed to be. And I have great respect for nurse midwifery. There is a place for both mm-hmm. types of midwives, and my calling is specifically in the community.
And so you said you were working full time. Was that the with the sonogram or sonographer?
Yes, sonographer.
And so you were working with that full time, and it sounds like mm-hmm. this thing kind of came out of nowhere. Was that here in Toledo?
The woman who called me mm-hmm. was in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
And so we sat down the next time in the next week or so over a 3-hour conversation, and she helped me map out how I was going to make this happen.
And so it didn't look like maybe it was going to happen, like you had kind of stepped back from it for personal reasons, it sounds like. Maybe, was it just too emotional at the time, or?
There were some personal things happening in my life that just required that I needed to have the support of a full-time job.
Yeah.
You know, like financially, a community midwife salary is not reliable or consistent.
Right. Right. And now you're offering these midwife services to people. If somebody was coming to you for midwife services, where would that conversation begin?
So if someone's interested, they typically find me online or through a family or a friend referral. Mm-hmm. We reach out to them in response to an inquiry that they submit on our website.
Okay.
So even if the pathway to speaking with me is very casual, I still refer them back to the inquiry form because it automatically populates into a spreadsheet, and I really love a good spreadsheet, keeping contacts in line and who and what and where and when. And so I ask everyone to fill out that inquiry form, and then I respond with more information specific to their interests.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that midwife role, where does that kind of begin in the pregnancy? Is that begin... even before conception, or like, where does that begin?
Typically not from me personally before conception. Mm-hmm. While midwives can provide care throughout the entire spectrum of childbearing years, my focus is primarily with pregnancy and birth and postpartum. So when someone is pregnant, they reach out, and we typically see them in the office between 10 and 12 weeks of pregnancy for their first appointment. If they were to have a miscarriage or need support before then we certainly provide as much support as we can. Mm-hmm. We as certified professional midwives do not have medical authority. We cannot prescribe medications. Mm-hmm. I can write referrals for things like that or put people into contact with things of that nature, but we have a limited scope. So mm-hmm. we usually wait till the pregnancy is far enough along that it's confirmed and then we start care.
And you mentioned this is kind of more in the realm of holistic healing. Mm-hmm. What was the value that you saw, and what is the value that you often kind of say, like, when you step away from somebody that you're helping, like, what is the effect that you kind of see as you work? I know that's kind of hard to say from your perspective. Like,
well, that seems a little very broad.
Right, so. Right. It is a broad question. Obviously, pregnancy has a lot of obstacles to help with. When you sit down with somebody, where do you kind of see the relief enter their body or their emotions or their psyche, or like from what you're able to give? Obviously it's like, you know, the holistic medicine world has a lot of different engines to it, I suppose. Yeah. And there is like a spiritual context to a lot of holistic medicine. Is it a spiritual thing that you're providing? Is it an emotional thing?
It's the whole mind, body, spirit connection with folks that really engages people who are interested in community birth. Mm-hmm. You're seeking that kind of relationship out from someone, and whether you want the more traditional approach to pregnancy and birth that is non-medicalized, mm-hmm. that provides autonomy, that provides empowerment, education, you know, and shared decision making. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the types of things that we're really bringing to the table with folks that allow them to relax and to open up and to share things that maybe are part of their whole experience. Mm-hmm.
That answers a part of it. I think what I'm getting at is more like, what kind of feedback do you get like from like your patients, like about like what you're supplying to them? Because obviously, like, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, mm-hmm. so you interact with these individuals, and what do they kind of tell you that they come away with after meeting with you?
Well, usually, a lot of people come to us after having some sort of traumatizing experience, and they're seeking that personalized care. Mm. Whether that was a previous birth trauma, or maybe they're having some other like psychosocial experience within the clinical medical establishment that they mm-hmm. want to move away from.
Right.
And so people will say to me, like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. I didn't know it existed.
Right.
Or they'll say, you know, thank you for providing me a space to be heard. and to feel seen in this experience. I'm more than just a number. I'm more than just a 15-minute window of time.
Right. It sounds like you're kind of guiding through the entire process. Is that kind of...
Yes, but with caution, right? Like, yeah. I'm never centering myself in someone else's experience.
Okay.
So while I might be a guide,
yeah,
it's supporting your desires. So I really make sure I understand what it is that you want
right.
from this.
Which is potentially why this question has been hard to find, because it's so personalized to each individual, which you mentioned. People, I imagine, fill out a number of different questions specific to how they want their birth to look like.
Yeah, they want to center their experience at home with family, where they feel supported and cared for.
What does midwifery kind of look like after birth?
So we provide birth from our birth support and immediately postpartum. We stay for several hours, and then we make sure everyone's stable, transitioned well, and we tuck folks into bed, and then we come back the next day to check on them. We're still on call if some emergency were to present itself. We leave people with a list of like warning signs and things to look out for, and whether their first call should be to us or to emergency services to call in quick support. And then we come back within 24 hours. We come back again on the third day postpartum. We either come back or call you, you know, periodically in between that and the first week, second week, fourth week, sixth week pregnancy. So there's a lot of continuity of care for mom and baby.
How long do you stay connected after the birth? Like you mentioned, you know, the next day you come in and things like that.
Yeah. Our guidelines pretty much envelop the 6-week postpartum period.
Okay.
We do send out invitations through email for clients to stay in contact with us, checking in on them at 3 months postpartum.
Okay.
And then maybe again at 6 months postpartum, like, hey, how are you doing? Do you need anything? And sometimes that might look like a referral to a nurse midwife for extension of care, for well woman care, well person care at that point.
Do you interact with people who experience postpartum or depression or anything like that?
We do. Yeah, it's not uncommon and is often misdiagnosed. And there are several forms and variations of postpartum depression that people go through. Anything from what you imagine as you hear those extreme psychosis stories, which are tragic, to other more minor things where you have like obsessive compulsive thoughts or rage and anger, things that might seem out of your normal behavior. And so we have conversations prenatally and postpartum, not only with the pregnant person, but with anyone that is in their immediate circle, on what are the signs to look out for and how can we support you if you have signs and symptoms that are not evolving over the typical normal hormonal period of time.
Excellent.
As hormones shift postpartum, we expect people to have baby blues, normal ups and downs.
Okay. So is that kind of an expected part of it, a form of depression? So are people caught off guard when they experience that?
I hope not. I hope that we do our best to normalize that for people. And it's definitely part of the intended conversation at 1 day and 3 day postpartum and our 1 week and 2 week check-ins. We're always asking, how are you doing emotionally? How are you doing physically? Are you able to complete your daily tasks and self-care? Do you have any emotional swings that aren't recoverable through moments of rest or peace, or, and do you need support?
So that is a pretty normal part of a birth.
It is something we try to normalize, to be aware of.
Because I think the cultural understanding about birth is there's a child, it's exciting, there's a celebration, you know, congratulations.
But there's such a huge transition for everyone in the picture.
Right, which is why your job is important, is because you're changing your life forever, essentially, with the introduction of this new child.
Yeah.
What has been the most, I guess, satisfying part of doing this job?
Oh, that's another really big question. satisfying part for me is I love standing in the threshold of someone else's transformation and witnessing it and being able to provide support when and if it's needed, or just the encouragement that you're doing so great and this is so normal, right? Like, and that can offer people something that they needed or didn't know that they needed to hear, to just embrace.
Yeah, even as you're talking about it, it sounds spiritual. It sounds this transformation. Yeah. So is there ever a time when that looks like a different way than you had imagined?
Yes, and you know, the first thing that comes up for me, but I'll preface this by saying it's also sometimes tragically normal, is when there's a loss or when there's a transfer that no one, you know, wanted. But we always say, like, for planned home births in particular, it's not home births at all cost. Our job is to monitor and be aware of any signs or symptoms that are presenting, like little yellow flags that, hey, something is moving you out of this spectrum of normal, and we might need to have more eyes on what's happening. And that might look like referring you for clinical care. It might mean risking you out of care entirely based on our scope of practice. And that can be really tragic depending upon when it happens, whether it's prenatally, whether it's in labor, or even postpartum. And so that presents its challenges as well.
How long have you officially been in capacity of like a certified midwife?
Well, June of this coming year, 2026, will be 3 years since I passed my national certification exam. But I've been doing birth work since 2001. But the official time frame has been 3 years, where I've been sitting as the primary midwife.
It sounds like an organic kind of build up to that many births that you've observed. And it sounds like you've gleaned a lot of knowledge from that. It doesn't sound like a whole lot.
Not just the births, but like all the other things that I've done.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, way back when I was going in the Army as a medic, working as a sonographer, working in the hospital community for 30 years, being able to have those professional relationships within the medical community. While I'm not a medical provider now, I have the ability to cross-reference and integrate when needed, which is something that is really huge and has not existed well for many midwives in our community. And my goal over the past couple of years has been to change that integration process and make it smoother and easier, not only for us as midwives or the receiving professionals at the hospital, but for our clients, so that they're respected and cared for and get the care that they deserve when we do have to do a transfer. So yes, it's all the things that I've done that like build this big package of experiences that I can apply. And it sounds so egotistical to say that, but like nothing is for naught. Like it's all worthwhile.
I don't think that sounds necessarily egotistical. That sounds like life. That sounds like how people kind of come to solutions, or they come to resolutions as they kind of get one thing and then they kind of build off of it. Who would you recommend to get a midwife?
Anyone who desires to have an autonomous experience in their birth. Our focus is on low risk, relatively low risk. There are like levels of risk, right? So we evaluate your risk potential. So you need to be relatively low risk and healthy. So again, there's parameters of that as well. So relatively low risk, healthy individuals that desire a home birth, not out of necessarily fear, but And again, sometimes that does frame the desire, but like the desire comes from like their natural desire for this experience to be at home.
You mentioned that you had an experience with two midwives for the unsuccessful pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Did you use midwives for your subsequent pregnancies?
Yes, I did.
Every single one of them?
Every single one.
Okay. there wasn't one where you were just sort of like, oh, I know the ropes or anything like that.
No, there are many folks that believe that they can birth autonomously on their own. That was never for me. I always knew that I needed support and wanted support from people.
Well, thank you very much, Shelley Varelli, licensed and certified professional midwife. And we'll be right back with more of Toledo Works. Welcome back to Toledo Works. I'm Steven Zenner with the Toledo Free Press, where we're talking here about women's health. And in the studio, I have Amelia Stower with the Toledo Women's Center. How are you doing, Amelia?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And what is your position with the Toledo Women's Center?
I am clinical staff, so I do a little bit of everything there. When we're in office, I work mainly front desk, but I also handle our funding and do a lot of assistant manager-like work, and whatever my boss needs me to do, I do a lot of paperwork for the clinic.
A lot of, so jack of all trades.
Yes.
Excellent. And how did you get into this kind of work?
So back when I was going to University of Toledo, I took an intro to gender studies class, and I decided I really love women's and gender studies, and one of the requirements for the major was you had to do an internship. And my professor at the time was like, well, why don't you go to the clinic? And I immediately was like, yeah, that sounds really great. I want to do that.
Which clinic did you end up going to?
Toledo Women's Center.
Okay, so you did go to Toledo Women's Center.
Been there 7 years. It was formerly Capital Care, but now it's Toledo Women's Center.
Okay, so in the past it was Capital Care when you interned.
Mm-hmm.
And how old were you when you interned?
19.
Okay, so you were there at 19.
Yep.
And then can you kind of take us through what happened in the subsequent years?
So after my internship was over, I stayed on because I loved working there, loved the environment. And then people started leaving, and it was really hard for the people that owned this clinic and the clinic in Columbus to manage both of them. So it was kind of like someone needs to take over this clinic or it's going to shut down. And I was like, okay, I can't let that happen. So I was like, school can wait. Clinic comes first.
So you put your education on hold to run the clinic. I was not aware of that. How did you make that decision?
It was a difficult decision because I knew my parents wouldn't be the happiest about it. But for me, it was more about what patients and people would need rather than finishing college, because college is always going to be there. If we lost the only abortion clinic in this area, that'd be more detrimental. So I kind of, it outweighed it for me.
And then how old were you when you took it over?
I was freshly 21 when I owned the clinic for about a year.
So you were 21 years old and you owned an abortion clinic.
Yes.
What was that like? That sounds like a head-spinning scenario.
It was intense. It was interesting, especially when people are like, what's your job? And I'm like, I own an abortion clinic. People do not believe you. It was hard work. I really enjoyed it because I had a lot of amazing people around me. I did get sued by Ohio Right to Life at one point.
I was gonna ask you about that. Yeah. So back in 2021, they took out a lawsuit on you, and not only have you done kind of these two things that I think people would shy away from, what kind of was that experience like, but also what were the feelings that were going through your mind running an abortion clinic and also getting sued?
I was terrified when my friend had called me and was like, did you know this was happening? And I'm like, no, I don't know what to do. I don't even know how to find a lawyer, where to go from this. But I ended up getting some amazing people. Peter Patakos out of Cleveland represented me, and then the ACLU of Ohio wanted to sign on, so they did. And so they took my case and ran with it. So they made me feel at ease, but it was definitely very terrifying to be working at the clinic and then get sued, because you never know what to expect, and it was just you don't want to get sued.
Right. I would say that's probably one of people's biggest fears in America is getting sued and the repercussions, the tax of resources, including financial and time and just the stress of it. This lawsuit began in March of 2021 and it ended in February of 2024. What was that experience like, just having that in the background?
I would say the first year was most difficult because that's when most of the case was actually happening, like getting the change from Wood County to Lucas County, and it was 2022, I believe, that we actually went in court and did the arguments, and I had to testify, and I was like, you got to prepare me for this. I don't know what I'm doing, putting me up on the stand. And that was the most difficult, most anxious time. But after the judge's ruling, I was a lot calmer, even though I knew that they were going to appeal it. But I was like, I think I'll be okay now.
And the judge did rule that their argument was moot in that case, because they were arguing that you were rendering medical care, which they ruled you were not doing.
I was not.
So regardless, you were kind of swept up in that. Mm-hmm. What were you doing in the clinic at that time?
At that time, it was 2022 that the current owner took over the clinic for me, because I'm like, this is just, I really need to take a step back, because I didn't plan to get into this right now anyway, and this is just a lot and overwhelming. So, but I stayed on because I love being at the clinic. So that's when I kind of stepped back and started doing what I'm doing now of front desk and kind of assistant manager stuff at the clinic.
And so assistant manager, that's just kind of making sure people go where they need to go and are ready for their appointments and whatnot.
Yeah, and making sure we have all the proper paperwork. And when we were going through our inspection to get our surgical license, I handled a lot of making sure our policy and procedure was up to date, writing down anything that was needed and updating all the paperwork, and just making sure we had our ducks in a row so that we could pass inspection.
I noticed a number of different things when I went on to the Toledo Women's Center website, including, you know, the ultrasound exam and different things like that. What is required under Ohio law to pass inspection?
So for surgery, there's many different things that are required, a bunch of, especially for ambulatory surgical facility license, you basically have to be up to the biggest code that almost hospitals have to do. So it's making sure you have all the proper equipment and sterilization, that you have all the proper licenses. And so it's a lot of different things that they're asking you to do, but abortion clinics have extra hoops that you have to jump through or wait extra long just to hear back from them. But they just ask a lot.
Yeah. And I've even heard, you know, like hallways have to be a certain mm-hmm. length, and that isn't like a standard length. Is that true? Or
yeah, hallways do have to be a standard width for it. Same with doorways. There has to be a certain number of fire detectors in the building. If they say to have 4, we put 6 up just so that they can't dock us on that. Mm-hmm. So you always kind of go above and beyond what they are asking if you can, so that they can't find anything to ding you on.
Kind of how you're expressing, and it sounds like there's a strong opposition to what you're doing at the Women's Center. And how does that kind of show up throughout your work?
When it came to getting the surgical license, it just made it very hard how long we had to wait. It was a year-long process just to get the inspection date set, and it took a couple of months just to hear back from the inspection, and we had to use our lawyer to be like, you need to get back to us. You said it would be in this certain time. It's past this certain time. And then even just outside of the clinic, we have protesters there, so I think that kind of is all a part of it too.
Right. And there's, you know, and this isn't just like a Northwest Ohio thing. This is across mm-hmm. all of the United States. There's a strong opposition to abortion, a strong opposition to women being able to make that choice for themselves. The details about, you know, the clerical types of things, it sounded like this person was potentially not going to get back to you unless you hired a lawyer to say, hey, you have to give us a date. Is that kind of par for the course for those kinds of things? Those are things that most people don't see. I think it's pretty easy to see a group of people protesting outside of a building, but it's a different thing to see, you know, you need to get this stamped. Well, we don't have a date for that. That's a different kind of difficulty. It's a different kind of problem to solve. How do those show up?
They just try to find excuses that they're not getting back to you this time. Oh, so-and-so's out of office, or oh, we haven't got this part back from so-and-so, or they just won't get back to you. A lot of times their voicemails were full, so it was really hard to get a hold of someone. So you're just sitting there like, okay, how long is this going to go on before, A, I can talk to a real person and actually hear a voice and not just have my emails being sent out to whoever hopefully reads them, but actually be like, sit down, we need to figure this out. So it was frustrating. We had to bring a lawyer into it because they kept just kind of wishy-washy, oh, so-and-so will get back to you, but then they don't get back to us.
Right. Is this is with the government, or is this with health, or
this is with the Ohio Department of Health specifically?
Okay.
They were difficult. And even some of the agencies before, like getting a plumber from here, we had to get a licensed plumber to come out and inspect our building as part of what we needed for the Ohio Department of Health. And even the guy who he's been since let go, but he was a city official plumber. He was very bad about getting back to us and coming out, and he kept finding new problems that our other plumbers were like, that's not an issue, I don't know what he's talking about.
Okay.
So we even had some issues here too.
Right. Even among, you know, professionals, mm-hmm. for building code and things like that, there you seem to just keep getting the runaround.
Yeah. We're kind of used to it. We kind of know what to expect, but it doesn't make it any less frustrating to go through.
Right. You took on that responsibility. You kind of handed it off, and it sounds like you're happy to hand off that responsibility a little bit. Yeah. What is like a day-to-day life in Amelia Stower's responsibilities at work kind of look like?
Initially, it's checking in patients, getting their paperwork all filled out, getting their charts together, collecting payments. But when I'm done checking them in, it's kind of whatever I need to catch up on at that moment. It could be doing follow-ups of patients after they've done the medical abortion and seeing if they've had what the results of their pregnancy tests are, and marking that down somewhere, or entering in the abortion reports to the Ohio Department of Health site that we're required to do, or submitting our funding for the month to whoever, which agency we're working with at that moment. So it's whatever is needed to do, because it's a lot.
Right. And it sounds like there's some different situations, different kinds of abortions, and different services that you provide at the Women's Center. So you have surgical abortions from 5 weeks up to 6.5 weeks.
Yep.
And then you also have medical abortion pills, 5 weeks up to 11.6 weeks. Are there any other services that you provide there at the Women's Center?
Not at this time, just abortions, but we also give out free Plan B to anybody who needs it as well. So we get a lot of calls for that.
Right, which is contraception.
Yeah.
Yeah. So between those two things, are there any kind of myths that you would like to dispel? Specifically on the website, it says abortions from 5 weeks to 16.5 weeks. There's a narrative about, you know, late term abortions and pregnancies like that. Would you like to kind of speak on that? That's a big talking point in politics, is, you know, people are going in right as they're about to give birth. So can you talk on that a little bit?
Yeah, there's definitely not as many late term abortions as you think. More people catch it quickly or somewhere in the middle. We even don't see that many people who are 16 weeks or sometimes we get people who are further than that because they didn't genuinely know that they were that pregnant, or they were trying to decide between it, because hey, we respect whatever decision you want to make, so, but we're, unfortunately, we can't go that far, so we'll refer them to a clinic that will. But it's very hard to combat some of the inaccurate things that are out there, like the abortion reversal pill, because they advertise that right outside the clinic, but it's not a legitimately science-backed information.
And can you kind of explain the abortion reversal pill?
So that is a series of medication that you would take after doing the medical abortion to help try to reverse that medication that you took to keep the pregnancy viable. It's not shown to work. There's no scientific evidence to back it up. There's also just a lot of misconceptions about how horrible it's going to be. And for some people, it is very painful, but we try to help give any medications they need to help subside with that. But some people, it's a really easy, pain-free, I mean, like physical pain, that it's not as bad. They come out afterwards and they're like, oh, that's it? That's fine. And there's also not a lot of emotional turmoil, I would say. Most people go in there and they know what they want to do. They've made their decision. And that's why we get a lot of same day patients, because they already have kids. They know what it's like. If they carry through with it or if they don't. So they know what's going on in their lives, and they don't want somebody else telling them what they can and can't do, or that they should have more kids. That it gets, I know, frustrates them that they are kind of being told what they should do. And they're like, I know my decisions. I don't regret it.
And that kind of goes into some of the services that you provide there at the Women's Center, counseling sessions. What are some of the other things that go along with the process of like a surgical abortion, and how does that kind of differ from the medical pill abortion?
So regardless, everybody gets an ultrasound and a consultation where we'll just go over what to expect depending on if they choose to do medication or surgery, and talk it over if they have any certain feelings about it or questions about the process at any point. And then after the consultation is when they'll meet with the doctor. They'll sign a consent form with them, and if they're doing the medication, they typically take that with the doctor right then and there, the first one, the Mifeprex, and then they go home with the second set that they'll take roughly 24 hours later. But for surgical, depending on how far along they are, after meeting with the doctor, they'll start getting medicated for pain, given some meso between their cheeks to help with their cervical softening, and then we'll take them to the back half of the building to get more comfy until it's time for their surgery, or they'll leave the office and bring the pain meds back with them on the day of their surgery. But regardless, everybody gets counseling and gets a rundown of what to expect.
And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Toledo Works Women's Health episode. Welcome back to Toledo Works. I'm Steven Zenner. I'm talking to Amelia Storer from Toledo Women's Center. And we were just talking about kind of how the abortions take place and what kind of those look like from a beginning to end process for patients. And we've talked a little bit about the opposition to abortions. I wanted to kind of jump more into the physical presence outside of the Women's Center. Obviously, you get protesters all the time. What does that look like? And I know that there used to be abortion center bombings and things like that. What does the opposition to the Women's Center look like in a physical sense outside of your building?
We always have protesters any day that we're in office. It varies day to day how many there are, but there's always at least a couple. We have regulars that we know their names and they know ours, but some days it's worse than others. There will be a lot more, that there will be more yelling and everything, where they just won't leave the patients alone. They're just standing there physically, staring in at support people in cars, trying to talk to them, even though they're like, no, please don't.
It sounds abrasive. Does it ever become dangerous? Are you ever scared for your own safety or for patient safety?
I haven't been. I don't think there's been a situation that somebody was put in a situation like that, but I do know that it's gotten ugly with some of the fights with shouting at each other that we've had to like tell support people to be like, okay, we understand you don't like these protesters, but they will call the cops on you for any reason. You should go back into your car right now and not get in their face.
And there's a whole grouping of volunteers that are going to help guide individuals who want an abortion into the clinic. But do you ever face more kind of like structural opposition? I know that the Haven was located right next door to your location. Is that still going on?
The Haven has recently left and moved elsewhere. A new owner has moved in. We don't know who, but we have noticed there is more anti-abortion materials that are posted on the building. So that doesn't give us good vibes about who
okay.
it's going to be.
So there is kind of a concerted effort in a structural way to kind mm-hmm. of hinder abortion. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of deal with that kind of an emotional disruption, I guess?
For me, it doesn't bother me at all. 7 years at the clinic, it just kind of rolls off my back, but it makes me more upset for the patients because they shouldn't have to see that. They should be able to just come in here like any other doctor's office without seeing anti-abortion messages or protesters. So that just gets frustrating. So it's nice when we have volunteers at the clinic because they're playing music, they have umbrellas so that they possibly don't have to see or hear any of that. So that makes me feel better, but I feel upset on the patient's behalf.
Is there anything that you do that like kind of helps patients feel more at ease when they get into the center, or is that just kind of they just have to run through the gauntlet as fast as they can?
We try our best to be a soothing. If they come in, they're crying, we'll take them into a separate room so they don't have to cry in front of everybody. If they need a moment, we understand if they need to call someone because we don't allow support people inside, unfortunately. But sometimes we'll be like, okay, they can stand in the doorway for a moment until you calm them down. But most of them are okay when they come in because the volunteers are there to help them.
Mm-hmm. And then you kind of talked about the process of getting an abortion, and then counseling is a part of that care. Is there any sort of post-op care besides the counseling?
So for medical abortions, every patient gets a 4-week message asking for their pregnancy test results just to make sure the medication worked because we can't physically see if they passed it. For surgery, depending on how far along they are, we might ask them to take a pregnancy test, but we're able to confirm if a pregnancy was, terminated with a surgical more easily. But we do have a 24-hour nurse line, and we do tell them, if you need us for anything, give us a call, and we'll figure out what it is. If they need a number for somebody to talk to, if they just wanted to talk to one of us, they have that option.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of bringing this back around full circle, I know that you said that you put your education on halt. Have you been able to get back into your studies?
I would like to, but unfortunately, if I go back to University of Toledo, I will have to find a different major because of Senate Bill 1 when it passed. It took away my women's and gender studies major, so I don't have that to go back to.
Okay, so is there a different plan, maybe a different university, or?
I do do not know because it's 13 credit hours. So if I just go with an undeclared major at UT, I could at least have that finished.
But it doesn't sound like you're super keen on doing an undeclared major.
Yeah, because I'd really like to finish out with women's and gender studies. So I'd have to see where is a program that I could do that and how many of my credits would transfer.
So for now, you're at the Women's Center.
Yes.
For an undetermined amount of time.
Yep, I love being there, so I can't foresee myself leaving at any time.
Well, thank you for coming to talk to us here at Toledo Works. Amelia Stower with the Toledo Women's Center, and I'm your host, Stephen Zenner. We'll talk to you next time.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.